You're listening to episode 19 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max.
Hey, David. Nice to talk to you again. I have some sort of disappointing news. I was hoping I'd be able to give an update on my little quadcopter learning to fly experience, but with the snow on the ground, I'm thinking I picked a bad time of the year to learn how to fly a quadcopter.
It just gives you time to sit and read the books on how to do it, even though that doesn't really help because you're not actually doing it. We won't talk about the weather, but yeah, I think probably, you know, you don't have an all-weather quadcopter, and I don't think learning in a snowstorm is probably conducive. What color is your quadcopter? Is it white?
No, I have a little green body on it, sort of a bright green body. So when I fly it into the bushes or behind the property into the woods, it makes it easier to find.
Ah, okay. It's kind of like orange golf balls. I got it.
Exactly. Well, David, what are the topics we have for this episode?
Well, we got some breaking news that there was a successful sense and avoid flight. On the other side of the spectrum, we have a Russian drone killer. Our ever lingering UAS test site selection supposedly is nearing. And, well, it looks like the voters are going to decide whether they can take their shotguns out and shoot the drones down, which has been an ongoing story for us. So I guess we should get started. Well, I guess our first news story is General Atomics tests a UAV that can sense and avoid other aircraft. General Atomics had a successful first flight in California of a prototype sense and avoid system, an SAA. We got to add that to the acronym list. Using a Predator B. Developing SAA is key to allowing UAS in U.S. airspace. Wow, could you have written a bigger tongue twister? radar, transponder, and traffic alert systems all work together for the first time to detect another aircraft. Pretty amazing stuff that we were just talking about how important this was, and it seems to be happening quicker probably than the FAA wants because then they're going to really have arguments against their delay when people are saying they can already sense and avoid aircraft, huh?
Oh, I see. You're saying they can take away that excuse for further delays. But, I mean, this is kind of a complex system. It's actually several systems. Now, different types of aircraft, if you're going to sense and avoid them, talk about the sense part of it anyway. Some aircraft make it easy to be sensed and others don't. Some aircraft have radios and transponders and broadcast signals, and others don't. So what General Atomics has done here is combine several systems so they can detect all of those kinds of aircraft. And so they have a BAE Systems, it's an AD-DPX-7 identification friend or foe transponder, and that's using automatic dependent surveillance broadcast, or an ADS-B receiver. There's also a radar system as part of this overall system. They're using their own General Atomics due regard radar. And then finally, the third component of it is a Honeywell TPA-100 TCAS, or Traffic Collision Avoidance System. So they're using the spectrum of these three systems in order to sense other aircraft. Sounds kind of expensive, doesn't it?
Well, it sounds kind of expensive, but it does sound off the shelf. I mean, the IFF transponder we've been using for years, every military aircraft has it, so that you know from a distance who your buddy is and who the guy you're supposed to be shooting at is. And TCAS is in civilian airliners. I'm not sure how off the shelf the General Atomics due regard radar is, but while it sounds expensive, it does sound off the shelf that they're not building something from scratch. They're taking existing components, and what they're doing is weaving them together to make one new system, though it does sound pretty complex for our run-of-the-mill guys that are in the civilian sector who are just getting up to speed with this stuff. I mean, this is a Predator. There's a large area for them to put this equipment in it, and they have access, and General Atomics, of course, has access to stuff that most civilians off the shelf probably don't have. I mean, I don't know how much an IFF transponder is, but it can't be cheap. So you're right.
That's kind of an issue, I think. All right. So maybe as this technology is being developed, it's, you know, large, physically large and expensive, and that's kind of what you expect for the, I guess, what amounts to the first prototype of this kind of sense and avoid system. But ultimately, I mean, you want this technology to be small, lightweight, and cheap. Now, it's not something, obviously, that's going to be in my little $100 quadcopter, but for other, you know, small UAS, you want to have this capability ultimately, you know, don't you?
Agreed. And I guess the cost is miniaturization. It's always it's always more expensive to shrink things down. But in this industry, I think they got to do that quickly, because if we are going to be using civilian drones in the airspace, or UASs or SUASs, we need to keep them small, lightweight. So I guess this is step one, is let's see if we can integrate the technology, and then we'll worry about miniaturization. But it's definitely a step in the right direction, and one that's coming fairly quickly, which is a good sign. I think if we're using a Predator to do it, it's also good news for the fact that we're using a Predator, and it's good news, and not
yes, right,
a drone, a Hellfire strike in the Middle East. But it's medium-sized, and Predator is male, and medium-sized, long endurance. I mean, it's the kind of drone that we want to integrate into the airspace. So I think we'll chalk this one up as to be continued, but in the first step.
Yeah, and a good first step. And it sounds like it was a pretty comprehensive first step. The Gizmag article that we're looking at that describes this mentions that in the course of this test, there were some 40 pre-planned encounters, it says, with other air traffic. So I don't know what they put up to be sensed by all this equipment on this Predator, but yeah, it sounds like a pretty good comprehensive test. So hopefully we'll see lots of progress in this regard. I mean, another aspect of this is, what's the intellectual property associated with this? Who owns the IP? Is General Atomics creating IP that's theirs and not going to be shared with others? Or is it something that could be licensed for others? I have no idea, you know, how that all plays out. So hopefully what they're developing is something that has, you know, broad applicability and can be used by many others.
Or if worse comes to worse, it's a model in which everybody else can build upon.
Right.
It may be proprietary, but I don't know how it could be proprietary if they're using Honeywell and BAE Systems equipment. But it's a, should I dare use the phrase, roadmap for sense and avoid? Because we don't really want to use the word roadmap, because we know what road that takes us down, sure, the one that we never return from. But I think that's, we're in the right step in the right train. So shall we move on to our next story, going the opposite spectrum from airplanes that are avoiding each other to UAV killers?
Yeah, this is a story we found in voiceofrussia.com. Now, as you might imagine, as the role of unmanned aircraft in military operations continues to increase, it was only a matter of time until we begin to see countermeasures that are UAV specific. And so the Russians are taking some existing hardware and modifying it to make it a little more usable for shooting down drones.
Yeah, they're modifying their Pantsir-S. NATO is the SA-22 Greyhound gun missile system to make it more effective at bringing down UAVs. The SA-22 Greyhound is a fire control radar, an electro-optical sensor, two 30-millimeter cannon, and up to 12 5076 radio-commanded guided short-range missiles. So you basically have a multi-aspect weapon system that And the Greyhound does something like fill the sky with, if you put enough ordnance up in the air, eventually you'll hit something. The common term would be flak, which was World War II. So, I mean, the fire control radar and the electro-optical sensor, the fire control radar moves it from a bigger distance. The electro-optical sensor confirms the target, and then you start firing with 30-millimeter cannon and 12 radio command rocket missiles, which basically you're flooding the area, and sooner or later you're going to hit something because it's going to fly through the flak. So it's interesting that Russia's building a system to target drones. I guarantee you that suddenly the Middle East will be dying for this kind of weapon system. So for Russia, it's a good weapon system that they can use to sell. It's interesting that you have to relearn targeting for lower, slower, or higher, slower drones. You're not shooting at things. So you have a different mentality when you're trying to shoot down a drone because it's persistent and slower and maybe easier to target, but you have to hear it coming and some other things. So they're definitely changing the scope of what they would normally be an anti-aircraft weapon.
Now, this thing sits on the back of a truck, doesn't it?
It does. It's a very portable system. So, I mean, a lot of surface-to-air systems now are, you know, you see them in third-world conflicts where they're just on the back of a really, literally, a pickup truck. So, I mean, this is a small pack, compact system that they can use, but it's typical military history. You know, my strong point, military history, for every weapon, there's an equal and opposite anti-weapon.
Right.
So it's always been, you come up with a weapon system and somebody else is going to come out with a countermeasure for it. And then you have to counter the countermeasure. And this is how we escalate as far as military hardware goes. So it's interesting that the Russians are pursuing since their drone programs are fairly limited, they're taking the other tack. Well, if we can't build them, let's try to shoot them down.
Yeah, and this doesn't sound like, you mentioned export possibilities of this equipment for Russia, and that kind of makes sense to me. I mean, I don't really have this sense that Russia is significantly threatened by the incursion of the drones from other countries. This really seems like something that they, like you say, can export to other areas, other customers that might really like to have this kind of hardware, this kind of capability.
And Russia is in the arms industry. They want to sell their hardware to everybody they can. So it makes perfect sense that if you can't beat the Americans and the Israelis, why don't you create the weapon system that can take out the American and Israelis? So it's a step in the right direction. Though I'm sure that sooner or later Russia will get back on to the drone program. I think they basically are looking at their falling into third place with China desperately trying to catch up to the United States and Israel. So it's export dollars. I mean, if you don't have anything to sell, you can't sell it. I guess that's important for them and for an economic reason. So
do you think, David, we're going to see kind of a drone arms race here across the world as a variety of countries decide that they don't want to get left behind?
I think so. I mean, everybody's going to want to buy in, and nobody really ever wants to rely on some external source for their military hardware. That's just a given. If God forbid you turn against that person, where do you get all your supplies, your parts and spare parts from? I mean, there's a reason why we scrapped all those F-14s all those years, was because we didn't want Iran to get the spare parts for their F-14s. So, I mean, that kind of, yes, I'm sure we're going to get in a UAV arms race. And unfortunately, the Russians have fallen rapidly behind. China is desperately trying to keep up pace with the Israelis and the United States. And in fact, the United States has always been trying to play catch up to the Israelis. So you always want to have the best, fastest, greatest, whatever. So in this case, they're really useful. And this week, though we're not going to discuss it in great detail, Nigeria is, and this is Nigeria we're talking about, is creating their own UAVs and going to put them into deployment to monitor their own borders. So everybody's going to want a stake in the game, I guess. And there's a lot of people who don't want to buy from the Israelis. There's a lot of people who don't want to buy from the Americans. So who does that leave? The Chinese and the Soviets? Yeah, so we have a bit of a Cold War again. So we'll see.
Interesting. All right. Well, bringing it back to the U.S. and to that FAA roadmap that you mentioned a little bit earlier, David, it looks like we're seeing some action, or we're about to see some action in terms of the test sites being announced.
Yay! deep down inside, I keep holding my breath. But 24 states are longing to participate in this grouping, you know, which is, it is kind of amazing, Max, that half of the country wants to be involved with UAVs, and we're constantly hearing how bad UAVs are, and that the country basically hates them. So there's clearly an economic base out there that says, you know, this is the way to bring revenue to our states through FAA centers of education.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the Bloomberg article that we're looking at mentions that some of these states are sort of on both sides of the fence. In other words, they're taking action, they're lobbying to be included in as one of the six sites that the FAA is going to create, and at the same time they have legislation, local legislation, to that's sort of anti UAS. So it's, you know, kind of problematic. But yeah, the idea is that the FAA is going to designate six sites in the U.S. They now say that's going to happen before the end of 2013, which only gives them a couple of weeks. And the idea is that these test sites would be where private researchers can study how unmanned aircraft can be integrated into the airspace. It's kind of a series of locations where the manufacturers, universities, local government, states can participate in sort of advancing the technologies and the knowledge about unmanned aircraft systems and how they can be integrated into the airspace.
And keep in mind, we did talk about the fact that Great Britain now has two sites.
Right.
We talked about, and they're leading the charge, and Australia wants to. So you need an area. These are airplanes. Airplanes need to fly. You need an area to fly the airplanes. They're going to be special centers where you can do that. And some of the centers are multiple states. I know of the Ohio bid is actually Ohio and I believe Kentucky and Indiana. I know there's a Mid-Atlantic bid where there's multiple states trying to combine their forces so they make a viable area. Like Maryland, Delaware, and I believe Pennsylvania has looked into it. I don't know if they've gone further enough, but so that, you know, you can fly them on the Delmarva Peninsula, which
right.
is away from. So there's a lot of states very serious. And when a state decides to team up with another state, they're extremely serious because they know that they need the strength of another state. So here in the United States, when two states work together, it's kind of an amazing thing.
Unusual, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, we have things like bridge commissions. Like here in Pennsylvania, we have the New Jersey and Pennsylvania work together because they have bridges that go from one state to the other. But this is interesting. And some of the states you read about every day, some of the southern states are constantly sending out emails about what their capabilities are. So this is a serious competition. And it'll be exciting when they are announced, because hopefully we can start pursuing each state to find out what they have to bring to the table for UAVs.
And the states do, at least those that are vying for this for these test sites, recognize that there's the potential for lots of job creation. There's the potential for them to create an environment that leads to future business opportunities in this area. And, you know, they recognize that there's a lot of potential value to the states to be in on this from the start. So that's their motivation. I don't know, after the FAA announces the locations, I don't know how much the lead time is really necessary or going to be necessary before these things are actually up and operational. You know, hopefully, I think because the motivation is so strong, hopefully these are things that can get started right away.
Well, I think you'll see 1 or 2 years, but a lot of these organizations have gone beyond first steps to, you know, in order, it's kind of like the Olympics. You sort of have to show that you have the capabilities of doing it. You have to show the infrastructure, then you go build the new stadiums.
Right.
But it'll be interesting. I guarantee you one of them will be Ohio, just because.
You think so, huh?
Well, I think.
Sentimental reasons?
Wright-Patterson is right there in that corner of that universe and where they want to have it. So they're Ohio is definitely leveraging the fact that they have a very potent Air Force base that deals with new technology, which is what Wright-Patt really does. So I think Ohio will be one of them. And if the FAA is looking and really thinking this through, you're going to want one up north where you can have cold climate testing. You're going to want deep south where you can have hot testing. And each one of these places has their own offering. So you figure Ohio will be one. One of the northern states will get one. University of North Dakota. And North Dakota is desperately trying to get it because they have a whole aeronautical infrastructure. One of the southern states will probably get it. And that leaves three more to smatter throughout the country. And I think once they become successful, I'm sure we're going to see more of them. But, I mean, the FAA is, again, taking baby steps, and let's have six so we can monitor them, and then we'll go from there. But I'm excited. I mean, this is going to be big news and roll. And hopefully, once we get the announcements, like I said, we can start hunting down these people and bring them on and have them tell us why they are the... It's kind of unfortunate that we've gotten a little too late in the game that we could have gotten these people ahead of the game to try to sell us on it, but it's definitely going to be an interesting opportunity in 2014 if they actually do make the announcement in 2013.
Great. Well, this last news item, you know, I almost hate to give these folks any more publicity, but we talked about them before, so we need to kind of, I guess we're sort of locked into following the story a little bit, but this is about that Colorado town, Deer Trail. That's the town that's looking at a proposal to issue hunting permits for drones. And we talked about that quite a while ago. Well, apparently there was a legal challenge to that, but a district judge has rejected that legal challenge. And so now all 370 of the town's voters will have an opportunity to decide this in a vote on April 1st, interestingly enough, 2014.
But you know what? I'd rather see it go down this way and not do the legal, not kill it via the legal challenge. Let the people vote. And a lot of the interviews and the stories that we've read about this have said that there's no guarantee that it's going to pass. There's a lot of those people in the town going, oh my God, why are they bringing this attention to our poor little town? And want to vote it down. So I guess we'll have to wait till our recording the closest to April 2nd, but it is what it is. This is the way we do things here in the States. And if a judge says vote for it, you know what, let's vote for it. And if it does get passed, then the FAA and everybody else will take a chance and then bring it to the court of law. But if we're lucky, cooler heads will prevail, and we will not, on April 2nd, have people shooting their guns in the air at what they thought was a drone and was actually a chicken. So it's it's the way we do things here in the United States to our international listeners. It doesn't necessarily make it right, but you know what? we call this a free country, and I don't remember what his name is, but it's his right to say that he has the right to shoot down drones until somebody makes a law that says that that's not right. So we've got 4 months where we can ignore this story, but I don't think we can because it seems to rear its ugly head every 3 or 4 weeks.
All right. Well, David, we got some feedback from one of our listeners, Bob Iverson.
Bob has been a longtime listener of Airplane Geeks, and he politely, and I really appreciate it, and I did know better, Bob, and you should know that, but I misspoke. Longtime listener of the Airplane Geeks podcast and recently started catching up on UAV Digest. I very much enjoy UAV Digest. Keep up the great work. As a private pilot, I'm quite concerned about the dynamic tension between the let's do everything now group and let's do something really stupid. Bird strike possibilities are bad enough. Let's not have Cessnas, me, or Boeings running into UAVs. My POV until UAVs can be certified for sense and voyage should be required. Stay within radio-controlled airplanes for requirements for FARs. I got enough to concentrate on during my final approach. And Bob, you're not voicing anything that we don't hear from a lot of our listeners, especially ones that have come over from the Airplane Geeks that are private pilots. We know that, and we're slowly trying to convert all of you one by one. It's just it's like the three wise men going, you know, we have a long-term goal to prove that Max and I are right. But in this case, he quotes and goes on to say, my reason for writing in episode 16, David was discussing the Global Hawk UAS system. I'm quite familiar with its near beginning since I work for Hughes, later Raytheon, the provider of the Global Hawk sensor suite. We talked about upgrading the Global Hawk imaging synthetic aperture radar to an IASA configuration. And he said, my reason for writing is David's comments about the imaging radar being in the Global Hawk's reason for its somewhat bulbous nose. Not true. Yeah, I know, Bob. It was the radar. I got it. But the SAR sensors are located in the belly of the UAS. So, yes, I'm aware that the UAVs are like Predators and Global Hawks have their data link antenna causing that big bulb on the top of the nose, and I misspoke, but I do sit corrected here, and I appreciate you correcting me, because, and like I wrote back to him, I said, one of the joys of this show for both you and IMAX is we don't know what we don't know, and it's a lot of learning curve for both of us, and I'm actually enjoying the fact that I don't know everything about this topic, even though I don't claim to be a know-it-all. I get accused of being a know-it-all a lot on Airplane Geeks. Yeah. But you did send us a lovely cutaway showing the radar, and I do appreciate being corrected, and I enjoy this because I'm learning something new every week.
We both are. I think we all are, including our listeners, and that's why we're doing this.
Again, folks, don't hesitate to correct us, because Max and I do believe we don't know anything. We just make it sound good, and we're learning a lot. So I think anytime you guys want to, if you hear something that we misspoke, we're the first to own up to it, and definitely feedback at UAV Digest. Don't hesitate to correct us, because the most important thing we can do is give out factual information, and if we're screwing something up, you got to let us know, and we won't take it personally, because we love good feedback and corrective feedback, or like what Bob sent. So, Bob, we definitely appreciate you as a listener, and I didn't take at all offense the fact that you corrected us.
All right. Well, I think that's it, David, for this episode. This has been episode 19 of the UAV Digest. You can find show notes at theuavdigest.com or the shortcut, theuavdigest.com/19 for episode 19, if you want to go right to that post. As David mentioned, you can send us email. The address is feedback@theuavdigest.com. And on Twitter, we're UAV Digest. And same on Facebook, UAV Digest.
And I guess this is the last episode of the year. Who knew that this time last year, Max, we would be doing an episode about UAVs, huh?
That's right. And had no plans a year ago for this, but I'm glad we've started. We've gotten off to a good start, I think. Boy, 19 episodes already. It's kind of amazing. And we're looking forward to 2014 to bringing you lots of good information, knowledge, offer a learning experience for everyone. And hopefully before we get too deep into 2014, I will be a proficient quadcopter pilot.
This time of year, I should follow up my normal tradition, hum a few bars of All I Want for Christmas is My UAV. My UAV. My UAV. Gee, if I could only have my UAV, then I could videotape Christmas.
There you go.
So, Merry Christmas to all, and Happy New Year, and most of all, thanks for joining Max and I on this ride this year, when I jokingly sent out a post in April saying, should we do a episode on UAVs, or should we do a podcast about UAVs? There's a lot of our Airplane Geek listeners went, that's a great idea. And then Max sort of went, that's a great idea. And next thing you know, we're recording it. So that's usually how this stuff happens, but we definitely appreciate everything you guys listen to. And here's to a great 2014.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening.
Happy New Year's. This is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.